all, I'd like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to present Shamran Petroleum. There's been a lot of interest in Shamran, and this is the third time I'm presenting it. So we've kind of made progress over the last couple of years, and the progress is obviously on two fronts. One of the most kind of interesting and challenging issues with this project is the political situation in Kurdistan. We know there are a lot of resources in Kurdistan, there are a lot of companies out there, but it's the political challenge which has been kind of highlighted quite a bit. Well, one of the things with the political challenge which is kind of important to point out here is that there are two levels of this challenge. One is what you hear on the news, what's going on a daily basis, what you hear from a lot of analysts, what's happening in Iraq, what's happening in Kurdistan, and what's happening in Turkey, etc., etc. But the other more important point is what's really happening on the ground. What progress have we made over the last couple of years, and how does this progress translate for some of the projects which we are doing? And that is the real point which I'd like to make, in the sense like, look, we are looking at the progress which we have made starting from 2007 when there was zero production to today, where, you know, there's more than 400,000 to 500,000 barrels of production right now. The critical point for Kurdistan always has been and will be, fine, you can produce the oil, you have the resources, you can get this, but how do you take it out? How do you export it? How do you get paid for it? And that is the area which has been, you know, there's been remarkable progress on that side of things. First of all, the big thing, big picture, Kurdistan has a pipeline of its own. It's a pipeline which has been went from Kurmala to Fishkabur, connects to the Iraq pipeline, gives Kurdistan the direct access to exports. The physical access to exports is there, proven. We had 400,000, there was a couple of months in the beginning of the year when there was continuous production of up to 250,000 to 300,000 barrels per day going through the system into Jihan, which was going to be exported to the Med. Then there's a lot of political issues, you know, these exports and the sale of all this oil could create a lot of turmoil in that part of the world. So effectively at that point in time, there was intense negotiations between Baghdad, Turkey, Kurdistan, and the US trying to resolve or come to a solution. The solution didn't happen because of political reasons again. There was elections in Iraq and everything else. And then the Kurds stopped the export of oil for 2 months, or I think it was about 6 weeks. And then now they started exporting another 100,000 barrels per day. And what's happened in this interim period is, in the last 2 weeks, basically Kurdistan has gone out and has been tendering for the oil which has been exported over the last 3 months. That was about 1.8 million barrels of oil sitting in Jihan. And it's the first time Kurdistan exports have actually gone to a terminal and from the terminal have been sold. So we see a line, we see a physical process which is actually taking place. Politics is still going to be a part of this equation. There's always going to be issues relating to that. But what has happened in the last 5 years is that we have, or Kurdistan has proven that it can produce the oil, it can go get it through the pipeline, and it can export and sell the oil. So that's the most critical development, which is way above, which is below the noise level which you see. It's all issues about Kurdistan and Iraq and all the politics behind it. But for people operating in the region, people developing their assets, this is what we've been looking for, and it's a very important and significant development. Coming to the next level, KRG and Turkey, this is, you know, a couple of years back, we always thought that the solution is going to be the some sort of agreement between Baghdad and Kurdistan. That's not happened. But what has happened is the KRG in Turkey, there's been a long, you know, the relationship, there's a long-term cooperative energy agreement. Turkey is looking at gas coming in from Kurdistan, from this region here, Sulaymaniyah. They get cheap gas, their imports, it helps the economy for the long run. Right now they import gas, $14 to $15 a barrel from the north, but this will help them in going forward. And this is the economic driver which is kind of taking place. The other thing which has also happened in the recent past is basically these policies were put in place by Erdogan, and you know, this election, there was some kind of gray areas where if he wouldn't have come, whether these policies would be remain in place or not. They are still in place. So what we see is, or what we think is going to happen in the next 12 to 18 months is, basically this relationship is based on economic foundations and the political advantage which Turkey gets. This is going to get strengthened, and with the kind of export sales being taking place, things hopefully will kind of get back on rails and kind of start functioning normally as one would expect in the long term. KRG Baghdad, the relationship still remains challenging. As I mentioned, there was intense negotiations and the pressure both from the US and Turkey to get to a solution. The solution didn't happen. I think it kind of got bogged down because of the fact that there were elections in Iraq. We expect that there's got to be some solution to this with Baghdad at some point in time. Because the other alternative is, if there is no solution, then if Kurdistan can sell its oil in the international market, get the revenues for themselves, then they really don't need to be part of Iraq. And that's a scenario which is, the world is not willing to accept it. The Kurds have already started talking about it intensely. And there's a lot of, if you read the local newspapers, there's an article on this every day in the Kurdish press. But I think, you know, there's, because of the continuous pressure, because of the fact that the Kurds have been able to export their oil, this thing, Baghdad will have to kind of come to some sort of an adjustment. With election results right now, you know, the Kurds will also have a very important role in forming the government in the future, which effectively will help in trying to get this thing sorted out. In addition to the what we've seen about this 400,000 barrels per day by 2015, we're looking at a capacity increases from Kurmala to Fishkabur. You know, the KRG's plans are like talking between 800,000 barrels per day to 1 million barrels per day, then connecting it to the Kurdish pipeline by including some pumps, and then other infrastructure being planned, heavy oil pipeline, the gas, there's talk of laying a twin. So there's a lot of progress out there. And this is really what I wanted to convey is, yes, there's a lot of problems out there, but the problems have not really affected the work on the ground. The work on the ground is going on. There's a lot of progress on that side of things, and we are happy to be a part of that. Atrush, most of you are familiar with our discovery. It was, you know, 2011, we made this big discovery. Atrush 2 was one of those biggest wells in Kurdistan, 42,000 barrels per day. We made a commercial declaration. The KRG came in with a 25% interest, submitted a field development plan. Atrush 3 was our eastern extension, which was 9 kilometers away. It proved the well, the eastward extension and the depth of the oil column. The field development plan, phase one, was approved in October 2013. We've drilled Atrush 4, which was a producer, which was our second dedicated producer in 2014. And in terms of production facilities and pipeline planning, construction is ongoing. And I'll talk about it a little bit more. We think Atrush is part of the accelerated regional development. Currently, there are two major producers in Kurdistan, DNO and Genel. And they can produce up to about 350 to 400,000 barrels per day. But the KRG ambitions are not 400,000 barrels per day. They're talking of 800 to 1 million barrels per day within the next 2 years. So Atrush is going to be part of that accelerated development. As I mentioned, you know, the phase one was approved earlier. We've kind of laid out the contracts for the field development of phase one. The production facilities modules were awarded in December of 2013. The civil engineering contracts were also awarded at the same time. Progress is being made right now. Civil engineering work should be completed by the end of early July, and then we should start getting all the equipment in, which is presently being tendered. I think the important thing which happened for us was, our original plan was that we would have a trucking terminal. We'd be basically putting our oil in tanks, taking it to Kurmala, and then putting it in the pipeline, because we weren't sure whether we would be allocated a dedicated point or not. This has happened. We have been allocated a dedicated point here, which we call the KCP2, the Kurdistan Crude Pipeline Pumping Station 2. And we've currently basically been allocated a corridor, so we'll have a pipeline coming right from the mount from Atrush 2, which is a production facility area, and going into this. The way it is structured at the moment is, it's going to be a dedicated pipeline for Atrush production, so we'll be able to go right through and go into this. The common corridor's been agreed, the feed contract's been awarded, and we are hoping that within the next 4 to 6 weeks, the final pipeline contract will be awarded. This is going to be an EPC contract to most probably the company which built this pipeline, who have a pretty impressive track record of building pipelines in country. So it's going to be a combination of ILF, which is a German consulting company, one of the biggest pipeline consultants in the world, and CAR, which is a local company for construction of pipelines. Just to talk about the Atush 4 well, it was a second phase well, a development well at the Cheercare facilities. Just mention Cheercare. There's no hidden agenda behind Cheercare. What has happened is there are two villages, one called Atush, one called Cheercare on the south and the north. So the Cheercare village felt that they were being left out of this Atush development. So just it's more the management committee requested that to keep things politically good, we should include Cheercare as part of the facilities. So that's the name change which we've done. The well was drilling operations under 11 days, testing operations took 44 days. It was a high angle deviated well. Very important, it was a proof of concept well also, because we needed to be sure that we could drill highly deviated wells, because Atush is in a mountain. It's very difficult to get access to proper locations. And if you do get access, then it's very expensive drilling, expensive building these locations. So what we decided was we needed to drill this well early in the phase, and that's what we did. So we were able to do it successfully, though a bit late than our AFA projections. The bottom hole location, 2.16 kilometers southeast of the surface location, and we reached the Jurassic Reservoir about 72 meters higher than the 81. Oil shows depth, and the kind of vertical oil column was about 580 to 600 meters. So again, proving what we had earlier, and also kind of taking us to the next level of the drilling activity which we need to do in this. Atush 4 well summary, I'll quickly walk through it. You've heard this, because DST1, basically DST1 on the log we saw that we could have an oil section there. DST1 was not planned, but because we saw it on the log, we decided to kind of penetrate that section, and it turned out to be tight, because it's just more of a data point for us, because we wanted to know what was there. DST2, basically 72 meters of perforations over three intervals. The highest reported rate was about 3,800 barrels. The well was not flowed at the maximum rate, so it's like this is on a one-inch choke. We started with 1,500 barrels, took it to a high level, and then stopped. Same was the case with the DST3 test, which has flowed up to about 5,200 barrels per day. Oil quality, the same kind of quality, looking at 27-28, which is in the same range as what the pipeline could take in. For example, DNO has 26-27-8 API oil. Two important things happened with this well. You know, there was always a geological model where, based on theoretical studies, there could have been a gas cap at the crest of the structure. Now, a gas cap at the crest of the structure could have had a significant downward revision in the resources. We never believed it, our auditors never believed it, but we still had to prove it. And with the test in Atush 3, we were able to do that. So that element of risk, which has been associated with our CPR reports, has gone. And the other important thing which happened was Atush 2, which is the well, which is 2.1 kilometers off this well, we saw instantaneous response on the well. So the moment we were producing Atush 4, we saw a response in Atush 1, even at 1,500 barrels. So effectively what it proved was this reservoir is completely connected with each other. So now we got connection between Atush 1, which was the well which was plugged in the mountain. We're drilling Cheercare 5, which will be kind of a replication of this. So within this kind of a circle, if you would draw it, it's all connected. Instantaneous responses between wells, which is great news, because that kind of will help us establish the productivity, be able to understand the reservoir better, and see how much production we can get out of these fractures in this field. Overall FDV philosophy, I'm just going to kind of emphasize here, you know, Atush is a big field. It's like 8,200 square kilometers. We still have three wells. So the way we're progressing development is we've got the full field development plan, which kind of gives us a broad picture, but focusing on phase one, phase two, and going forward. So it's a modular field development. We haven't waited to drill 8 or 10 wells. We've kind of got to our wells quickly. We're using a phase modular and evaluative process. Development has been initiated on the west central part. Then we have drilled a well on the eastern part. And then basically we get a reasonable characterization of the reservoir, and subsequent phase developments will target the eastern end, then come back to the western end, increase facilities. So the idea is that once we get down to 30,000 barrels per day, hopefully the cash flow which we generate from this during this period and the revenue which we generate should be able to fund our activities going forward. This is kind of a schematic of the phase one development summary. You can see this is the plot plan. It's at three different levels because it's mountain, so you've got to cut the mountain there. And this is the activity which has been going on. I've already talked about the pipeline, which is a pretty significant development, and hopefully it gets awarded in the next couple of weeks. Then we can, you know, get on with it. The phase one facility, basically, this is what we've received from the operator. We've got the FEED study completed, ITT is issued for modules, civils contracts, we've got the power plant done, the third producer has been drilled, it's currently been spudded. We'll have one more producer and I'll talk about it. And the delivery of modules facilities with the overall objective of trying to get this first oil in 2015. This is based on what the operator has been telling us, and we hope that there will be no problems in the execution of this program, because it's not like John was mentioning, it's not technologically, it's not that challenging. It's onshore, it's standard stuff. Yes, we do have H2S, etc., but that's normal. That's something which we can deal with. Talking about our well program, drilling, what are we going to do? Basically, CK5, which is going to be our third producer out here, it's been spotted on the 16th of May, so a couple of days back. It's a 60-day well. We will not test this well. We will just drill it, suspend it, and then our plan is, because we've got this location built around here, we intend drilling one more producer from here. This is like a future producer. The reason for kind of bringing it forward is, you know, once the production starts, it's always going to be difficult to bring a rig in and drill while we are producing. So to avoid sign-ups and stuff which would create problems here, we decided that we'll kind of bring this CK8, as we call it right now, and that will be drilled back-to-back with the current rig. We have the Chinese rig called DQ31, which has been a very good rig. It's a big rig, and so we will drill this back-to-back on the same location, hopefully saving them time for testing and the cost associated with it. We'll go complete the well and then test it later on at the end of the year or early next year. In terms of the Eastern program, this is just the phase one which I was talking about. At the same time, you know, this is a big field. There's an eastern flank here which is very, very significant. So we need to kind of keep up the appraisal activity on that so that we can sanction the phase two of the project early next year, you know, somewhere in the first quarter. Once we start getting into production, we need to sanction this so that we can bring this into it. So what we are planning to do is we will be bringing in another rig. DQE will drill 5 and 8, and then we basically the contract will be over. We bring a new rig in, which will start with CK6, drill this well, then go to Atrush 3, because we need to retest Atrush 3. The previous test results were not representative of what we think it should have been. And effectively, then early next year, we will drill CK7. Which is going to be halfway between the eastern and western facilities. One of the things is, it's just not phase one development. We are at the same time appraising the field, kind of positioning ourselves for phase two, and also in terms of wells, we could have 5 wells by the end of first quarter 2015, which effectively means you could tweak your facilities, hopefully get some better production, higher production there. Talking of resources, again, it's kind of interesting, you see, because once we drill the eastern well, there's a lot of negative kind of sentiment associated with the well because the test results are not that great. Got to realize it was a flank well, 9 kilometers away, which proved the kind of the well. And if you look at the oil in place numbers jumped up by 30%. That was because the uncertainty in the oil water contact was reduced. So we had we had much less uncertainty there. And we're talking of a field which has got over 3 billion barrels in place in the P50 case. Now coming to the next set of numbers, we were able to get, because the phase one was approved, developed, and fully funded, and we were able to get reserves, so we've got 2P reserves of 58.2 million on a gross basis, and in the year, we've still got contingent resources about 518, so adding the two up, we are still at about 600 million barrels, 2P plus 2C. The 2C is contingent on the approval of phase two and, you know, the results of these wells, etc. But we think that's more or less the sanction process, you know, funding available, partners agreement, government approvals, to kind of put most of these continued resources into reserves. And I think this kind of gives you the, again, the size which you're talking about, the 20.1% interest rates have a significant stake in this field. The other interesting thing is, you know, at the same time, just the recovery in this is now less than 20%. You're talking of a reservoir with multi-Darcy reservoirs, you know, PIs between significant PIs and everything else. But given the kind of uncertainty, or given the fact that we do not have a production track record, our auditors are giving only 19% or 19.5% of this. So there is a significant upside on just the recovery factor alone. If you go back to the history, I mean, DNO was in the same stages 5 years back when they did not have significant production. Their recovery rates were 16-17% on their audited reports at that time, that point in time. And today they're at 36-37% depending on which reservoir we are talking about. So that's the kind of significant upside we're talking about. The other upside, which is going to be kind of targeted in probably second quarter of 2015, is this potential, the prospective resources. It's a very interesting, and I get a lot of questions from shareholders who seem to be very, very interested in this, is what is happening here, the footwall. Now, it's very difficult to get a geologist to agree on what exactly is happening here, but one of the things we know is that the Shaikan block has an oil-water contact of 14, 15 meters. Our oil-water contact is 420 meters. Now, we know that their footwall is non-sealing, so there's oil on the other side. So effectively, this oil should spill into our block, which is what we think has happened, should happen. The question is, how big is this column now? You know, if this fault is sealing, then this whole thing will be full of oil. If this is not sealing, then the model kind of gets a bit more difficult to explain as to why do you have a huge field already which is against a non-sealing fault. So it's complicated. It's not something which we will be able to answer right now. And all we've done is we've gone back to our auditors and told them, this is what we think. We think the fault is sealing, and they have given us these resources up till here, which is just a sliver of the overall potential of this. So that's, and that is reflected here. This is also pretty significant, but if the fault is sealing, then it could be huge. But right now, as I said, this is not going to be targeted in the near term. It's going to be 2015 or later when once we finish off our phase one activity and kind of sanction phase two, and then we go into the next level of development. In terms of cash positions, just kind of quickly talk to the financials. We raised this bond, which is $150 million, with a two-year kind of escrow account for the interest. Currently, we, based on a 20.1% interest, we've got $58 million. Debt service is about 21. So based on what we are seeing right now, or the projections which the operator is giving us, we should be able to fund our activity till first off. There's obviously the risk of execution, timing, and stuff like that. Projects can get delayed. So we just have to wait and watch. It's an execution issue. It's not an issue of finding the oil. We found the oil. We just need to kind of move on ahead with this. Again, probably the most important slide for us, Shamran, because you see, our partners in the block are TAQA, which is the Abu Dhabi government, Marathon, the KRG. We are a small company, but the fact that we can sustain ourselves, can work in that environment, which is pretty much a big company environment now. You know, you've got the likes of Exxon, Chevron, Total. So every big company is there. So being part of the group, being able to get the support from them on all levels has been very, very critical for us. And I think that shows that we can sustain ourselves going into the future. Just a couple of corporate statistics here. Market cap was $325 million as of 12th of May. Important, a lot of interest in Stockholm, in Sweden's markets. We traded 1.1 billion shares in 2013, so Shamran's probably one of the bigger traded shares in this part. Just a quick, I've just put this because there's a lot of technical questions which I get from our shareholder base, and talking about GeoCare, just a change in nomenclature, nothing's really changed, it's just basically AT has changed to CK. These are the historic wells, you know, Toosh one, you know, was a discovery, and Toosh two was a big one, for, you know, which kind of produced 42,000 barrels, reduced our uncertainty. Toosh three was a flank well, again, kind of giving us the oil water contact, the uncertainty was left 90 meters. And then this is the test which we did between a Toosh one and a Toosh two, which was 3.5 kilometers away. So complete connectivity between a Toosh one and a Toosh two. And we've also demonstrated connectivity between a Toosh 4 and a Toosh 2. So effectively, we've got connectivity all over. This is just the reservoir descriptions. One of the things which has happened is Kurdistan, you know, everybody calls the reservoir differently. So what we've been trying to do for the last 2-3 years is get everybody to kind of have the same nomenclature. And this is the new nomenclature which we'll be using, basically based on the generally accepted nomenclature by all the operators. So you still, you might still see somebody talking about Alan or Mus or something, but hopefully all of us are talking about the same region rather than kind of mixing it up because we have a different interpretation. This is again the same thing, and this is kind of the GIK structure. And you know, again, to some of the people who wanted to know what the footwall could look like, this is what it could look like. This is our hanging wall structure. This, not our hanging wall structure. Sorry, this is the Sheikh Ali structure, which has just been published in the Gulf Keystone CPR. So we think we have something very similar to it. So we should have something here on the footwall side of the thing. We have, we know we have all this going in. So effectively, we see similar kind of structures around us, both in the east and the west, and we, our structure should also be similar. And then these are the cautionary statements. With that, I'm ready to take questions. I'm sure you have lots of them. Yes.
What about the other part, Soratika? How will it belong to us? What's going there? Because we see that it's opportunity there also.
Yeah, Soratika is basically, you know, it's the block on the north.
Yes, but it's our block. I mean, it's our...
It's basically, you know, the Soratika structure, the Sarsang, it's the Sarsang block, and the Soratika structure comes right into our block at the Jurassic level. So right now, there's no intent to develop that part of it. We are actually carrying some of it in our resources. And at some point in time, you know, we will develop it because it's part of our field. So at some stage, there will be this demarcation, you know, or delineation, and we may have it. But the field is so big at this point in time that you really need to just focus on this. Because Sarsang, they've just declared commerciality recently, and their development plan will take another year and a half, so nobody's going to take any oil anyway. But yes, it's connected. We definitely see it on the maps that Soratika is connected to.
We saw this, that it's connected, but the first time you're saying this.
Well, it's always been on the maps, in the sense that...
I have seen this on the map, yes.
Yeah, because you see, to call it connected, it's on the map. You know, till we go drill that, you know, till we drill the Soratika Sinek, you know, we can't really say much about it. And,
yes,
you know, try to keep the information.
But we can guess. You cannot say, but we can guess.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you can't guess. You know it. You know, it's pretty clear there. Yeah. Yes, please.
What's the future role of GAB for Chamarov? What's the future thing about that?
GEP?
Yeah,
GEP is 100%.
Yeah.
No, GEP is 100% owned company of Shamran, so it's like any other subsidiary. It's just that the asset was in GEP, and when we did the structuring of the transaction, we earlier owned 1/3 of GEP, but now basically the 66% got sold to Taka, the operator for this of the block, and we own 100% of GEP. So it's like any other subsidiary. So there's, you know, it's just part of Shamran. No specific role for GEP other than carrying the Atush block PSC interest in the interest, and we just carry on with the work. No, it's already ours. It's 100% belongs to us. So there's no need to change anything. It's all done. It's approved by the KRG and everything.
Yes, I have two questions. My first question is, do you feel that Shamaran can, there is quite much information that you can disclose because of KRG?
Because
of KRG. Yes.
KRG. No, I don't think that's the case. What happens in disclosing this information is, it's a complex process. First of all, you know, we are not the operator, so we get the operator to drill these wells. Then the first decision is whether the operator is going to make a press release or not. You know, they have to decide because these are big companies. Generally, it is not material for them because it's part of, you know, it's a small part of their portfolio, so they don't make press releases. Now, once that happens, then we have to go out and basically get the approval of the operator, our partners. And once that happens, I mean, we first have to take our own internal approvals with the board and everybody else. And then we have to go back and do the KRG, because the government has to approve every press release. So every press release goes to the minister, which takes time. And in that process, you see, to put any interpretive statement is very difficult, because it's fresh off the, you know, like test results, it's just coming off. We don't know, we can't interpret it. So all we are reporting is facts, which is why it tends to be smaller. We try to do that later on when we make corporate presentations and everything else and try to answer questions on the relevant information, which is more interpretive, which takes a little bit longer. So it's not that it's difficult, it's not that, it just takes time. And also we want to make sure that everybody's on board with the information which we are providing. You know, we are not the operator, so we want to make sure that most of the time we try not to give our own information. What I think is not what I can talk about in public, so I try to give the operator's image and our interpretation of what we think is happening at that point. So it's not a KRG problem, it's just the process, and we have to follow the process because that's part of our PSC, you know, requirements.
And I have a second question. I think you have seen that the stock price has gone downward. Do you have anything, any plan for to keep it in a specific level or something, because it's very low right now?
I can't say anything about stock prices in the sense, like, obviously, you know, there's two things which we think is, you know, one is all this noise in Kurdistan, in Iraq. You know, what you hear is very difficult to, you know, dispute because it's happening there. But what we're trying to say here is what you're hearing and what is actually happening on the ground in terms of physical reality is slightly different. And most of the shareholders have had long patience. You know, you're getting tired of it, 4 years now. Okay. And I've been doing it for 7 years, so I've been, you know, telling the same story. But I think the critical thing there is, it is the last frontier. It is onshore. You know, we talk about fields which are, we're looking at wells of 50 barrels, 100 barrels, 200 barrels, 500 barrels. A good discovery is like 1,500 barrels per day. Here, we get 9,000 barrels per day, and the stock price goes down. You know, what else can we do? So I think it's a mix of everything, but ultimately we've got to look at the asset. So do we have a good asset? Yes, we have a good asset. We have a significant share in it. We are focused. You know, we're not trying to do anything else at the moment. We look at opportunities, but our idea is, okay, we need to kind of get into cash flow. We are dependent on operators. You know, we have to balance that requirement. So a lot of, it requires a lot of patience, I guess, you know. And the stock price is the stock price. You know, ultimately, you'll see, if you believe in the asset, if you believe in the fact that Kurdistan will export oil and this is going to happen, then valuations will go up. And that's the reason why you see the likes of Exxon, the likes of Chevron, they're all there. They're all waiting for something to happen. I mean, it's big enough to move the needle for them. So it's big enough for us also. So that's really what it is.
Thanks.
In the absence of an agreement between Baghdad and the Kurdish regional government, the outcome of that agreement to be, can that significantly change what you conceive you have agreed upon on the sharing of future profits?
Yeah, I think what you're referring is to this pretty age-old argument about the production sharing contracts and like that's opposition to the PSCs. I think we've moved a long way away from that. The fact that there's 40 companies out there, the fact that, you know, people are producing, people are selling the oil, is already kind of ingrained into it. So that is no longer under dispute. I think the real issue now is we've gone way above the contractual levels to kind of getting into the political domain, where if you read the Kurdish press, you know, they're talking of independent plebiscite in the next 6 months to break away from Iraq. You know, so we are now reaching where the Kurds have put themselves in a position of advantage. And if this Turkish pipeline, you know, works in over a period of time, you know, that's the direction it will take. So I don't think any disputes on the contract is going to deter the killer or back.
Jag tror jag hade en fråga längre bak först också.
No, we did not. Based on the current information we have, we did not drill through the fault. So we haven't tested the footwall as yet.
I have some. I have so many questions, but
please.
But however, it's important because it's the communication. And you have a friend that is telling us that he receives a lot of calls for everybody, from everybody. What calls you receive?
Sorry, calls?
What calls from other company do you receive to ask who are interested in Shabaran?
You mean from...
I mean, what came... Somebody is calling me.
Yeah.
So I think, who is calling you.
Frankly, you know, we haven't shown any interest. So we haven't, you know, we think it's a great project. We think there's still a lot of value to be accrued here. The important thing here is, you see, there's a lot of discount in Kurdistan for the barrels which you're talking about, simply because of the fact the politics is not solid.
Yes. Okay.
So the question is, if you've sweated it out for 5 years, why would we look at it now?
Okay, but the second one, why you cannot invite the media there and to show them what is KRG? Because it's important.
No, we did our, you see, initially when we were operating, we took the media and everybody else, but the KRG today, if you kind of just go and see the KRG website, I mean, there's no need for media. I mean,
But it's not the same when you take the guy from an agency in Sweden and show him exactly.
We can do that. I mean, you know, we've seen a lot of people.
I think you should do people don't think. They don't see the difference between KRG and Baghdad.
No, I think that's something we've done with any other companies within the Lundin Group, and we'll certainly be willing to do at some stage.
Yeah, I think you see it's a question of
they can help you because they have to write something positive.
Yep.
We understand because we are the shares holders. We know a lot. I believe me that we know a lot.
Yeah. I agree with you at some point.
They know what they are speaking about when you read what they are saying.
Yeah. We can do that at some point.
We'll definitely take it on board and, you know, find the right time to kind of...
think about
it. Yeah. No. That's something always in the back of our mind. But, you know, given the kind of stuff, we just wanted to take them at some point in time when the development activities, you know, you're reaching first oil kind of thing. So. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Pradeep. I think we had a very long evening here, and we'll continue outside. And if there are more questions, Pradeep will be here. So thank you. And before we leave, I wanted to leave over to Lucas Lundin to say a few words. A big shout out to both companies.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Jag bara tacka alla för att komma hit. Och det är så intressant att se alla aktieägare här. Mycket välinformerade vad håller på med, så ni vet mer än jag vet. Det är ganska imponerad. Och vi har två olika projekt, ett i Kanada och ett i Kurdistan, men de är båda jätteprojekt och de är båda mycket intresserade. Båda projekten har enorm potentiell, så jag är glad att vi är stora aktieägare själva, har varit stora aktieägare länge. Jag tror vi kommer se potentialen i nästa 2-3 år på båda bolagen ganska snabbt. Och John har här lovat att han kommer hit oftare och träffa oss. Men jag ska tacka alla så jättemycket. Jag ska också tacka John Festival och Pradeep Kabra och Robert Eriksson här för organiserat allting och för er för att komma hit ikväll. Men tack så jättemycket.
Och John vet ju hur saker och ting fungerar, John.
Mr. Tradition, idag. This is to the famous festival. This for the famous. Keep the business going. And then, I didn't know you were coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.